into the forest. All right, so we're into this next section of page 53 into this book, Just Enough, Lessons in Living Green from Traditional Japan by Asby Brown. I'm here with Abe and Rory. I don't know, this is going to be like the fifth podcast, I think, from this, maybe?
Fourth?
Fifth. Something like that. All right.
We did two last time.
Yeah.
This is the fourth.
Okay, so this is the fourth. All right. I think this is a good point to say. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but I think that this book is crazy awesome. Did we mention this in the podcast before? I'm not sure. But I just want to make it clear, and as we're reviewing this, I am thoroughly enjoying it because it's kind of like, you start thinking about a lot of the stuff. Like, we're going to talk about a lot of forestry stuff today. And it's like, oh, yeah, if you're going to do forestry stuff, you're going to have a chainsaw and a truck and, a sawmill is handy. And now we're, like, looking at this, and it's kind of like, oh, yeah, no, it's so much easier.
Go get an axe. Get yourself an axe. And there you go.
Well, and it's like, granted, that's a lot more work and everything, but it's like, I don't know, if you take good care of your axe, it's kind of like the old story about Paul Bunyan, you know, and how Paul Bunyan could chop down a tree faster than the guy with the chainsaw, which, you know, of course, it's a tall tale and everything, but, all right. I marked off the very first little bit in this section.
Before we get started, I want to say that this section called Into the Forest is kind of a misnomer because there's a whole lot more than trees in the forest, but pretty much the focus of this section is trees. Trees and trees only.
Well, no, they mention once in a while about people foraging, for food in the forest. But it's like, it's not like, oh, and then here's what they would forage for. It's just, oh yeah, people would forage. It's dominantly, and when I think of forest, to me, and I know Neil Bertrando feels differently, but when I think of forest, I think of like, oh, we're raising trees for lumber. And it's a piece of land where it's over there, and we there'll be a day where we're going to come and just clear cut. And while I was reading this, I was kind of thinking about, like, people are like freaking out about the bugs eating the trees. And I kind of think, probably the worst problem the trees have are people.
Yeah. Although what I was saying is that this section is all about trees.
Yes, right. And there's more to a forest than a tree. But I like the word woodland. I think woodland denotes a symbiotic relationship with the land and the trees, whereas forest to me means a place where we go and chop down all the trees periodically or chop down lots of them. It's for logging. A forest is for logging. And so I like the word woodland. But anyway, all right, so into the forest. Shinichi and the other residents of Aoyogi Village spend most of their time in and around their homesteads and fields, some of which occupy the lower hillsides. They frequently spend days a bit deeper in the mountains gathering food and fuel. But the villagers also participate periodically in logging activities that take them even deeper into the forest. While some of their farming activities provide for local needs, most of their rice finds its way to Edo and other large cities. Similarly, the lumber they help produce is intended almost entirely for the urban market, linking the well-being of the city to the environmental health of the countryside even more closely. In forestry, as in farming, an ethic of conservation and husbandry prevails. So now this is the first time I've ever heard of forest husbandry. So like the word husbandry being used to refer to plants of any kind, or trees, which I thought was really kind of cool. All right. Moving along, you guys have anything more? I'm moving on to page 54 now.
The Cryptomeria species is what they refer to as Sugi throughout this book, and we were wondering in one of the previous podcasts what the heck that is. And I looked it up, and it is what the English speakers call a Japanese cedar, but it is not a true cedar. and it's a genus with only one species in it, Cryptomeria.
Okay.
So it's like cedar, but it's not cedar. And the Zelkova that we were also wondering about is elm.
Why can't they just say elm? Man, it's like those Japanese, they have a different word for everything. Natural forest growth is a cycle of succession, where grassland sponsors scrub, which gives way to broadleaf species and possibly conifers. Prior to man's arrival and for long thereafter, the native forests of central Japan were a mixture of deciduous broadleaf and conifer. And where broadleaves with their broad crowns dominated, chestnuts, oaks, laurel, beech, the understory, which received ample sunlight, was rich in grasses, shrubs, and other plants, while also providing niches for abundant fauna. The broadleaf forest is by nature varied. Sugi and hinoki trees, tree species, are taller and narrower than broadleaf trees, however, and grow more closely together, so the dark floor of a climax conifer forest is usually awash in fallen needles and ferns and little else. All right, so then I think this is kind of a validating thing of most coniferous species. I mean, I think the progression is that you're going to start off with your grasses, then you're going to go to your scrubs, then you're going to get your broadleaf species, and then the conifers are going to get started and move in, and since they're allelopathic, they kind of poison out their neighbors, and they can grow taller and kind of start shading out some of the deciduous trees. So they say, oh, a climax species is, or a climax forest is going to be heavy on conifers. And it's like, well, that is true. That might not be what we really want to have. But so anyway, I felt it was important to kind of point that out.
Hinoki, by the way, is cypress.
Yeah, they've got all the trees that they've listed here. Lovely drawings of them, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
And what they're calling them in this book, which would be I'm not sure if it's the word they still use. Probably is. And then the words that we most commonly know them by. Not their scientific names, but their common names. Then on page 57, they've got a drawing, which is like the exact same drawing that we see in almost all permaculture books, where it's talking about edge. And you've got your, on one side, you've got your grasses and forbs and brush. And then as you start to progress there, so you start getting the bigger brush and then some small trees. And then it's like showing, the tall trees and the understory and the shrub layer and all that kind of stuff. So they're showing, a rich forest. And you know, usually we look at this to not only talk about edge, but also talk about forest gardening and sun scoops and things of that nature. So, talk about a correlation to permaculture. This is a very strong correlation. You guys got anything?
Yeah, I recognize that image, all right. There's all kinds of talk in this section about who has access to the forest and how people can use which trees for what, and it really reminds me of the way water is dealt with today in the American West.
The water that falls on the roof of your house is not yours.
Well, it depends on where you are.
Yeah, yeah. But in a lot of places, it's not yours.
Yeah, we have water rights. It seems like they have varying forms of tree rights.
Well, it sounds like, and when you read a lot of this, it starts off that it was like clear cut, like not just like, oh, that 80 acres of there is clear cut. It's like all the trees are gone. And then they kind of got to this whole point somewhere along the line where it's like, oh man, we are all so fucked. And so then it's kind of like, okay, how did we screw all this up and how are we going to fix it? I mean, we're really feeling some pain now. So then they kind of got into this place where, like, they're regrowing all of their forests, and it's like, you know, the number one way to make it so it does grow is we got to, like, you know, not cut it all down. And so then now they've got, like, these really tough rules about don't be chopping everything down, damn it. And it sounds like their rule set has evolved and evolved and evolved. Now it's complex, and it sounds like they now have somebody who's kind of put in charge of a forest, and then the community argues a fair bit about who gets to have what from the forest. But really, it's like, oh, it's owned by the city. You know, it's owned by the higher ups, really. But they'll let you go in and have some of the scraps from the forest. They might even let you have an occasional tree out of the forest. So, I mean, it sounds really sophisticated, but rooted in, like, environmental disaster. Like, this is, like, I think that's a big part of what this book is all about, is it's like, no, they had total environmental disaster, you know, before the Edo period. And then basically, it sounds like a lot of the Edo period is what they did to recover from their total environmental disaster in order to be able to stay alive.
It makes sense. They had to regulate it pretty hard because everyone needed wood.
Yeah, everyone wanted the wood, and it was like... and it sounded like for a while there, and they talked about like these big bronze Buddha statues or something, and it's like, oh yeah, we got to burn two or three forests just to melt the metal to make this enormous statue. And then they harvested a lot to build big palaces and stuff, you know. And then they, anyway, so they were just harvesting like crazy. Now it's like, okay, we got to regulate this or else people are just going to just wipe it all out like instantly. So anyway, it's a lot of it. It's like, well, how did those regulations start and how did they evolve? So anyway, the book goes into a lot of detail about a lot of that kind of thing.
One thing I noticed was that it talks about larch harvesting the needles, which fall in the autumn, using them for fertilizer for the fields, which
sounds like a hassle to me.
Yeah, raking up pine needles, but yeah, good example of a nutrient accumulator.
Although, you know, that nutrient accumulator would probably do pretty good for the larch plant itself. You know, if you just left the needles there, probably do good things for that larch.
Mm-hmm.
But now we're taking it away, so we're robbing Peter to pay Paul.
Right. But if you kept it in place, it seems great, you know.
You know, and I it just now occurred to me that the whole robbing Peter to pay Paul thing always works out for Paul, never works out for Peter. And I am Paul. All right, so moving along.
There's special trees. There are special trees referred to as tomiki.
Right.
Those trees basically, no matter whose land they are, they belong to the king or the emperor.
Right.
Because they're just so awesome that no one else deserves them.
Well, and it's like, oh, we're going to come get this later, but we will allow you to gaze upon it for now. But dibs.
So, yeah, it talks about a tree in the yard of Shinichi that's been there for about 200 years. And Shinichi knows that at any time it could be cut and carted away with no compensation to him or his family. And that just sucks.
Well, I don't know. A magnificent tree that's there. I mean, they could have cut it earlier or... I mean, maybe... When I read that, I kind of thought, okay, you know, it was like the land was purchased by his grandfather or something like that. And it's like, okay, so when Gramps bought the land, it's like, oh, yeah, dude, when you're buying this land from us, there's a catch. And that is that tree right there, you can't ever touch it. And it's like the belongs to the emperor and stuff. And so, like, you know, how those samurai like to lop off people's heads if you piss off the emperor? Yeah, just, you know, little word of the wise, don't touch that tree, okay? It's like the deal that comes with this land. If you're cool with that, we'll give you a sweet price. And so I imagine that it's not like, you know, by the way, we lord over you and we came by your house and thought that, like, your wife was awesome, so we decided that she's ours now. It's not like it's anything like that. I kind of have a feeling that it's like it's been well known since the property was purchased. So it doesn't seem too weird to me.
And it's not all completely one-sided. Shinichi does have special permission to fell trees for home use or special needs. So you can get permission. It just seems like a bureaucratic nightmare.
Oh, yeah.
It's like probably like what it's like to obtain water rights today if you don't have water rights on your land.
My understanding is that it's like pretty much impossible to like have an exchange of water rights unless you're like buying something like the big chunk of land. But it's kind of like I remember when I lived at Mount Spokane, I was told that I did not have the water rights to my land, and that I was allowed to collect enough water to be used to water so much of a yard or garden or something like that. But I was not allowed to irrigate any crops. I was not allowed to, you know, there's a whole bunch of stuff I was not allowed to do. But the water that fell on the roof of my house belonged to somebody else. And that somebody else allowed me a little bit for a couple of things, but nothing else. And in Colorado, it was a pretty huge deal. I think in Colorado they might have straightened it out recently. But there's a lot of states where it's like, yeah, the water that falls on your property does not belong to you. Now, I think that there's ways to mitigate that, you know, like through interesting plowing techniques that look a lot like swales, you know, or hugelkultur beds. And then it's just weird how the water that, you know, their water that used to just go down the river in the wintertime mysteriously doesn't go down the river until summer. I hope that they can cope.
It just seems totally bizarre because it's not like this water belongs to everyone. It's not that. It's this water belongs to someone else.
Right. And you know, with the forest, that's the other thing, too. It's kind of like, here's this 500-acre forest, and it kind of belongs to the emperor, but he lets people onto it to do some stuff. So our guy here, he doesn't, like, he's got his little, what, 4-acre patch or something like that, and he's working his 4-acre patch, and that forest, it's not his, that belongs to the emperor, but it also kind of seems like they go and get a lot of food out of that and stuff, and so they're kind of dependent on that, and they get wood for fuel, so they kind of need to go out there, but it's kind of not theirs, and it kind of is public, kind of. So it's the section of the book goes into a lot of detail about a lot of the political and bureaucratic gobbledygook of the era on this chunk of land. So then at one point he goes and talks about the communal life of elite woodsmen, which is a bit further down in the book. Do you have anything before the communal life of elite woodsmen? Rory, do you have anything?
I'm not doing a very good job speaking for the trees, I guess.
So forest stuff is, like, not your thing?
No, I guess not. Talk about silviculture.
They root cuttings. They plant them. Apparently, the Cryptomeria species roots from cuttings, which is good to know.
It shows that they are doing clear cuts still.
Mm-hmm. And possibly some monocropping. The clear cuts, it says, in most cases, however, the site is quickly replanted as a conifer plantation.
Yeah, it's kind of a drag.
And also it talks about removing brush from the forest when they're replanting. It says removing brush and large obstacles.
So then it gets onto the thing about the communal life of elite woodsmen, and it kind of sounds a little bit like, I don't know, maybe a lot of people listening to this podcast are not familiar with the stories, but, you know, 100 years ago, a lot of people went up into the woods. There'd be like a pack of 50 guys, and they'd go up into the woods, and they'd start cutting down trees, and they'd get them all, you know, moved down, and so they had logging camps. And so basically, sounds like exactly like the same thing, only it's in Japan. Big old logging camp. So these guys would go around and they'd kind of like build themselves a shack out of logs. And they would build all kinds of things out of logs. And then when they're all done logging there, then the logs would be then packed up and sent down as logs for sale. It looks like they did a lot of stuff where they would square up the logs before shipping them. Fair enough. I guess it's a smaller log, easier to pack around that way, easier to move around.
It mentions that their speech is full of bluster and they carry themselves with a swagger.
It sounds like they're cool.
Yeah, it sounds like the image you have of loggers just about anywhere. You know, they're big, brawny, tough, loudmouthed, belly-laughing sort of guys.
So cool. So cool. All right, and that's all I've got on this section. Do you guys have anything else?
Forests harvesting in the winter. It says their busiest times during the winter. It doesn't say why, per se, but reminded me of Mark Vandermeer here in Missoula with his Bad Goat Sustainable Forestry Company. They harvest in the winter because the ground is frozen, and doing work on the snowpack damages the soil substantially less than doing it in the summertime. It causes less erosion.
Yeah, if the ground is frozen hard, then it's much better on the land. But it's like if you go out there on a day where it's warmed up a bit and it gets muddy, do not go out there on that day, because that'll really compact the soil and mess it up. All right, are we done? Yeah, thanks for your contributions, Rory. Yeah,
anytime, Paul.
Yeah,
anytime.
Way to go. All right, if you like this sort of thing, come on out to the forums at permies.com, where we talk about forestry, woodland, homesteading, and permaculture all the time.